This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Cinemas and theaters can now allow 50% seating capacity of vaccinated clients.
That was Zimbabwe's Minister of Information announcing the easing of pandemic restrictions. Details coming up. Also, Tanzania's opposition leader appeared in court yesterday for the first session of his trial. And former President of South Africa Jacob Zuma says he is too ill to attend his trial next week. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. 5 weeks after Tunisian President Kais Saied seized governing powers, and a week after he indefinitely prolonged emergency measures, Tunisians are increasingly puzzled by his silence on the biggest crisis of their democratic era. He has yet to name a new prime minister or say how he plans to govern. Regional political observers say Saied's next steps will determine whether his intervention will ultimately be regarded as a democratic reset or a gateway back to autocracy. Radwan Masboudi is president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Washington. He explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the reasons behind the stagnation in Tunisia and the direction the president may be taking the country.
I believe that Kais Saied thinks that representative democracy is a corrupt system. He does not believe in representative democracy. Instead, he wants to establish direct democracy without political parties, because he thinks that political parties are corrupt, without NGOs. Also, he thinks that NGOs are corrupt, and probably without a parliament also, because he thinks that members of parliament are corrupt. So he sees himself as the savior of the country, and he wants to install a new system based on local committees, similar to what we saw in Libya under Gaddafi, for example. Right now, he's starting to face growing opposition from many corners within the Tunisian society and also from the international community. So that's why he still has not announced a new government or a roadmap, both of which would be illegal and unconstitutional without the approval of the parliament. And therefore, he is currently on very murky legal and constitutional grounds.
Saied's next steps will determine whether his intervention, called a coup by critics, but widely supported by a populace weary of paralysis and economic decline, will ultimately be regarded as a democratic reset or a gateway back to autocracy. Which direction you think he would be able to take Tunisia to?
I think it's true that the transition to democracy in Tunisia was incomplete, and that the Tunisian people are disappointed by the lack of improvements in the economy and also by the lack of improvement in social justice or in fighting corruption. However, I believe that we can and we must fix our democracy, that this democracy is still work in progress and is still incomplete, but it can be fixed. This does not mean that we can fix it by reverting to dictatorship or one-man rule. I think most Tunisians want to see a more effective government that can fight corruption and achieve economic development and prosperity, but at the same time, they also want this government to respect the tenets of democracy and human rights, as we have known them in Tunisia for the past 10 years.
But are Tunisian civil society organizations able to pressure the president to produce a roadmap or move into the right direction?
Yes, I think so. It's not just him who, I don't think he has the right to produce a roadmap or to impose a roadmap on the Tunisian people. This roadmap has to be negotiated and has to be discussed and ultimately has to be approved by the parliament. The Tunisian people will not accept one person to decide which course Tunisia to take. It has to be negotiated, and it has to be the outcome of a national dialogue that includes all the different political parties and NGOs and civil society, etc. So I think President Qais Saied is currently under a lot of pressure to develop this roadmap, but he cannot develop it alone. It has to be developed with the participation and the inclusion of all political parties and civil society.
That was Radwan Masmoudi, president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Washington. He was speaking with my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawi. A high court judge in Dar es Salaam today ruled the trial of the leader of Tanzania's main opposition party can proceed, and he rejected the defense's motions to dismiss it. Freeman Mbowe appeared in court yesterday for the first session of his trial. The French news agency AFP reports he is accused of terrorism financing and conspiracy in a case that has sparked concerns about the state of democracy and the rule of law under President Samia Sulu Hassan. Mbowe and three co-defendants have been behind bars since July 21st. Supporters of Mbowe's Chadema party accuse police of torturing him while in custody. Representatives from the British and U.S. embassies attended yesterday's hearings, as well as senior leaders from the Chadema party. After the sudden death of President John Magufuli in March, there had been hope his successor would bring about a new era of democracy. However, government critics say the arrests indicate that that is not happening. The former president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, says he is too ill with an undisclosed medical condition to attend his trial next week on several charges, including fraud, money laundering, and racketeering. The charges are connected to a multi-billion dollar arms deal that Zuma helped facilitate when he was a senior official of the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, in the 1990s. The former president is serving a 15-month jail sentence for contempt of court for refusing to testify at an inquiry into graft when he led South Africa between 2009 and 2018. Darren Taylor reports.
A military doctor appointed by former President Jacob Zuma has backed his claim that he's seriously ill. The former president has not disclosed the nature of his condition, saying it's private. South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority, or NPA, wants its own medical team to examine Zuma. The former president's spokesman, Mzwanele Manyi, says Zuma feels very insulted by this.
President Zuma's attitude is one where, for lack of a better word, it's actually hurtful in terms of how he's being treated.
Hurtful is an impolite Afrikaans word meaning fed up. Zuma has over the years presented medical certificates to courts as proof that he's too ill to testify. Earlier this year, a judge openly doubted the validity of a doctor's certificate and threatened Zuma with arrest should he not appear in court. Zuma then attended the hearing, laughing and joking with supporters and showing no signs of being sick. Now, says Manyi, Zuma's integrity is once again being questioned.
Infrastructure has been put into place to second-guess the opinion or the view of the South African military hospital. Now, President Zuma is saying, why is this that I'm treated like some kind of a liar here?
Manyi says it's within President Zuma's rights to refuse any medical exams.
No person can be forced to undergo any medical examination by anyone without that person's consent.
But medical legal expert Dr. Herman Edlinger says state prosecutors have the constitutional right to question the doctor's report presented by the accused and to contest it with a medical report of their own.
Any opinion evidence that is given by any expert is allowed to be countered by an expert appointed by the other side. Now, in a case like this, where the issue is the state of health of the accused person, it is essential for the expert of the other side to be able to view the person's medical records and to do a clinical examination of the person in order to be able to come to an independent opinion as to whether he is or isn't too sick to go to court.
In early August, Zuma was taken to a hospital outside the prison where he's jailed and had surgery a few days later. He's not said what the surgery was for. The court postponed the next session of his trial to September 9 after Zuma was hospitalized. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The World Health Organization says that there is no evidence that a woman from Guinea who tested positive for Ebola after arriving in neighboring Ivory Coast has the disease. Her diagnosis in mid-August was thought to be the first confirmed case of Ebola in the West African country since 1994. The French news agency AFP reported she had traveled to Ivory Coast's capital Abidjan by bus from northern Guinea, a journey of about 1,500 kilometers. Her positive diagnosis sparked a huge contact tracing operation by WHO and Ivorian medics targeting those who were in immediate contact with the woman. Now, with new test results from a laboratory in France, the WHO says the woman did not have the Ebola virus. It also added that after more than 140 contacts of the woman being traced, nobody showed symptoms of the disease or tested positive. COVID-19 cases have been decreasing in Zimbabwe as the third wave of the virus eases in the country. This has prompted the government to review restrictive measures put in place to contain the outbreak during the peak of the wave. Reporter Kuzaiza Nwashi has more.
Minister of Information, Monica Mutswangwa, explained the progress made in curtailing cases of COVID-19 during a recent cabinet press briefing in Harare.
Cabinet noted a 30% decrease in the number of infections, with 1,785 cases having been recorded during the week under review, compared to the 2,564 which was reported the previous week. This reflects that the infection control measures implemented by government are yielding results. There has also been a corresponding decrease in the number of people in need of hospitalization for COVID-19.
She adds, because of the drop in the number of cases, the government has reduced some restrictions.
Cinemas and theaters can now allow 50% seating capacity of vaccinated clients, and that all workers who work there should be vaccinated. National arts galleries across the country be opened to vaccinated clients only. And once again, all the workers who work there should be vaccinated. The resumption of sporting activities subject to strict observance of COVID-19 prevention measures and protocols should be done. Attendant staff should also be vaccinated. For all local activities in which the participants are below the age of 14, that is in sports, they shall, in all cases, be checked for COVID-19 symptoms, have regular temperature checks, and follow all the social distancing protocols.
Political analyst Vivid Gwede explains to VOA the thin line between encouraging citizens to take up the vaccine and violating their rights.
While it is sensible for the government to continue encouraging citizens to get vaccinated, it would be a violation of Zimbabweans' constitutional rights to begin to put measures that discriminate against unvaccinated citizens. Vaccination is a matter of choice.
Zimbabwe is a largely Christian country, and churches have already been allowed to reopen for vaccinated citizens. Critics say all measures being implemented to reopen the economy for vaccinated Zimbabweans will force many more Zimbabweans yet to be vaccinated to reconsider and take the vaccine. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashe from Harare.
A senior United Nations official says Africa's road to economic recovery will depend on the continent's access to enough COVID-19 vaccines as countries continue to respond to the debilitating impact of the pandemic. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports. So far, up to 30 million people have been rendered jobless across Africa, while the effects of COVID-19 have pushed millions into poverty. Vera Songwe is the Executive Secretary of the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa.
Today, the conversation on prosperity coming to the continent is a conversation that must and has to go through how we win and fight the fight against this pandemic. For us to get to prosperity, we must first of all jump the COVID-19 pandemic challenge that has been put in front of us.
Speaking recently in a virtual meeting, Songwe said only 2.3% of Africa's population of 1.3 billion has been vaccinated against the coronavirus. Africa has secured at least 400 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccine, but the continent needs 1.6 billion for its people. Dr. John Genkasong is the director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC. He says health security is both an economic and a national security issue. Genkasong, a Cameroonian virologist who has been the face of Africa's fight against COVID-19, says he expects 30% of the population to be vaccinated by December.
And my fear is that we are still treating this pandemic as if we are in an acute phase of the virus. It is not. We are now entering into a more sustained phase of a pandemic, and we're counting on support uptake of vaccines and support testing. We need to launch into mass testing using antigen tests so that you know your status. And if you know your status, you can protect your loved ones and protect yourself.
Kennedy Odede is co-founder and chief executive of Shining Hope for Communities, or SHOFCO, a Kenyan grassroots organization that works in poor neighborhoods in Nairobi. He says governments need to work with leaders in poor communities to deliver vaccines.
We have to understand that if we don't take care of those living below in our society, we are living in a time bomb. My agenda has been, we need to have trust with our institutions. You cannot force any citizen in Africa to take the vaccine by force. So let's go down to our local leaders. Let's go down to our religious leaders. Let's go down to the chief. Let's have a conversation. Otherwise, you will bring vaccines. Nobody will take it. So my agenda has been on how do we bring everyone on the table, especially whereby community leaders, they are feeling that they are part of the future.
The virtual discussion was organized and hosted by the Economic Commission for Africa as part of its monthly conversation on Africa's recovery. The series, titled It's Your Turn, features industry leaders, celebrities, and experts who share their vision on what growth for Africa will look like post-COVID-19 and what they will commit to do to drive prosperity. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The United States aid agency says rebels from Ethiopia's Tigray region have looted aid warehouses and trucks in the Amhara region. The head of the U.S. aid mission in Ethiopia, Sean Jones, made the comments yesterday on Ethiopian state television, EBC. News agencies say they could not reach TPLF officials for a response. Northern Ethiopia has been racked by violence since November when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed sent troops into Tigray to topple the TPLF, the regional ruling party, after what he said were attacks on army camps. Thousands have been killed in the fighting, which has spread to neighboring Afar and Amhara regions, and tens of thousands displaced. USAID have said 5 million people are in desperate need of aid, and there are estimates that about 400,000 people face famine conditions. Aid workers have struggled to reach victims, saying roads often have been blocked. Both the Ethiopian government and the TPLF blame the other side for the aid access problem. Brighter Bridges, a London-based research firm focusing on Africa, reveals that the African edutech ecosystem is robust and Nigeria takes the lead. In Lagos, Naija Kids, an edutech company founded by three sisters, has developed an online and mobile platform that helps children ages 3 to 13 years understand and retain knowledge using interactive fun games. For more, Africa's 54's Pauline Niho via Skype spoke to Titi Adewesu, co-founder of Naija Kids in Lagos.
And what we simply do is we bring digital learning to children, but in a different kind of way. We make it fun. We all know that children love to play, and so we use play-based learning to help teach children anything. So we basically take anything and we say to ourselves, how do we gamify it? How do we make it fun? How do we make it exciting? So that children learn effortlessly. We want children to acquire skills, acquire knowledge in anything that they want to, but in a very fun and engaging way. So we do games, we do quizzes, we do worksheets. We've now also added doing interactive books, anything that would just make learning fun.
That's remarkable. How did you guys get started?
Honestly, it actually started with my son. So my younger son just was someone that just didn't like learning. Anytime it was time to do his school homework, any of those things, it was always one excuse or the other. Oh, mommy, I'm coming. I'm going to the restroom. Mommy, I'm coming. I think I'm tired. Oh, I think I'm hungry. A 20 minutes homework could end up taking us 3 hours. And then I came across a quote that said, if children don't learn the way you teach them, maybe you need to teach them the way they learn. And so I looked at him and said, you know what? He's very engaged when it comes to anything digital. So maybe what I can do is take some of this, his homework, take some of this, his content, and just make it digital, something that, you know, I can put in his device. And so I sat down with my co-founders, who are actually my sisters, and we sat down and said, okay, let's do this. And that's really how we started.
Interesting. I wish, looking back when I was a kid, I wish I had something like this. I think I would have turned out to be a better person. So what's the response been like? How are people responding to this initiative?
I think the feedback is the one that warms our hearts the most. You know, when you look at all our achievements, really the feedback. So there was a public school, a government-owned school that we used to take our devices to like once a week as part of our way to give back to the community. We go there with our devices, about 20 devices, go sit with the children for like an hour. Some days we do math, some days we do English, some days we do science. You know, the first feedback that we got from the principal of that school was that attendance was high on the days that we came. So they'll tell them, oh, you know what, if you're not well behaved today, I'm going to tell them they shouldn't come this week. And so, you know, like, no, we want them to come and play the games. And then the other thing we then saw was there was improvement. The teacher noted that they wanted to learn, because when they go back and play the game, they want to ensure that they do very well. So they were more, you know, ready to listen in class, just so that, you know, they can do well, you know, when they actually play the game. So it was just wonderful to hear that. And that was even before the pandemic. So suddenly EdTech became the forgotten child, is what I like to say. The forgotten child suddenly became the, you know, the prize and the favorite child. Suddenly everybody had no choice really but to move to technology, and they began to realize a lot of the things that they had left on the table. So we entered 2020 with a lot of people suddenly realizing that yes, you know, they needed to embrace online learning. It gave them a lot more opportunity, but they also realized something, that online learning is tough.
How about in terms of content development? You say that you love doing that. Are you developing all the content yourselves?
We currently develop all the content ourselves. So we are made up of, you know, educators as well in our team that develop the content, review the content. We also have kids that help provide the content, you know. So we in 2020 we started doing short stories, so we have quite a number of kids that wrote the short stories, and they was all excited to see their short stories being published on our platform. We get ideas from the children in terms of developing the content. Even when we do develop the content, we do the initial testing with a group of children, say, oh, what do you like about this game? They'll tell you, oh, you should have done this, you didn't do that. So but all the content is actually developed here.
That was Africa's 54's tech correspondent Pauline Diho speaking to Titi Adewezu, co-founder of Niger Kids in Lagos. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehigi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.